Welcome to Reconsider. I'm Bill Hartman. This is the podcast to challenge you to ask better questions, to look beyond traditional models of thinking and arrive at better health and fitness solutions.
We can talk about the misconceptions about like how hands are analogous to feet in certain ways, but also not. And then we can even go to the lower extremity as well. Sure. So it's just like, let's talk about the misconceptions first, I guess.
Okay.
So when we talk a lot about in the model, like the medial foot contacts and needing to make sure you have like, in order to superimpose internal rotation, not to orient too far into external rotation, you need to maintain some semblance of contact with the medial aspect of the calcaneus and your heel.
Right.
And the first metatarsal head.
Yeah. So here's the reasoning why that has to happen. Okay. Now, even if you overcorrect and you overload the medial foot contacts, it's still IR.
Yeah.
Might not be relative motion IR, but it's still IR. The reason being is because your legs are on backwards. Okay. So when you were made and you were still in mommy's belly, you were an ER monster, right? So you're a fish. So you're based on our water-based ancestors at that point. So when we're developing extremities, all the extremities are formed in ER. The IR comes later. And so that is the bias under all circumstances. And this is why, okay, so like the It boggles my mind why people don't make a bigger deal out of the fact that the dorsum of your foot, dorsum means the backside. Why is the dorsum of your foot face forward? Right? It's like, oh, because it's not the front of your foot. It's the back of your foot. It's just twisted into IR. So if we need to superimpose IR to stand up, push into the ground, whatever it might be, right? That's why we have an extremity that does this. And so if we're going to capture internal rotation from the ground up into the system so we can store energy for the release of energy and late propulsion, we have to be able to internally rotate. And so those medial foot contacts represent the ability to do so. That is why,
right?
That is why that whole concept is in existence. Now, the question mark is okay, is this going to be relative motion or is it going to be compensatory strategy? But that's beside the point. The whole point is like, I have to be able to internally rotate to push down. And that's why we talk about medial foot contacts all the time.
Yeah. And I think we did the recent golf swing webinar. I think thinking about things in terms of the swing, when you think about like, if you go into a right-handed golfer goes into their takeaway and their backswing, if they lose that inside aspect of the foot,
Then there's
really nothing that can be done with using the ground when you start to bring the club down towards ball strike. The IR will have to come from some type of side bend or some sort of twist or orientation because you've kind of lost your ability. So it's like drawing like the bowstring on a bow and arrow and then kind of letting go of the hand that's holding onto the bow.
Correct.
And then trying to throw the arrow.
Well, it's like, well, how do I create downforce under that circumstance? I have to grab the two ends of the bow and I have to pull the bow literally to create to store energy. I no longer have the bowstring to squeeze the ends of the bow together. I have to manually grab the two ends of the bow and bend it. And that's basically what compensatory IR is. So when we talk about like loss of vertical dimension, or we talk about compressive strategies, we're talking about like the twists that take place outside the base of support. That's what we're talking about. That's why they're very energy intensive. And that's why they're very uncomfortable, right? These are the people that walk into the clinic and they go, man, it hurts right here. It's like, yeah, because you got so much downforce going through this one space because you have to be able to push into the ground. Like to walk into my purple room, you have to be able to push into the ground. How you do that determines basically the outcome as to whether this is going to be relative or compensatory, adaptive, right? Or do you have a structural, did you have to change a structure to do this?
Yeah. Right?
And that's what creates all these problems. And that, but if you don't identify those, if you don't identify each of those representations, then you're kind of lost as to what to do. And then you just kind of do stuff and you hope for the best. And sometimes it works and sometimes it doesn't.
Well, or you adopt a model that tries to compare the hand and the foot and the lower extremity to the upper extremity directly without appreciating some of the things that we just mentioned. We'll go into a little bit further detail, but as like a starting point, understanding that everything develops in ER from this sort of like plates, fish representation. And then the lower extremity has to twist in a way so that it's almost like it's been screwed on backwards versus how it was, how it's represented in the upper body. So that understanding that, it's sort of, it makes you kind of put away the thought of like, oh, well, gait on your handstand walk is gait for the upper body. It's like, no, it's not, because of that, because of what we just explained. And then further, we'll talk about how there's a misrepresentation of hand and foot contacts as an analogy too. Like in a lot of cases, certain models will say that like this part of my hand under my index finger would be the ball of my foot, which is wrong.
That is because wrong.
And from there's no splitting hairs here, and there's no nuanced discussion. It's like, this is your big toe. So why would this be the ball of your foot?
Because it's not.
Yeah, it's like, no,
it's crazy simple that it's not.
Actually. I don't need to explain it to you, but like, I just want people people not knowing anything that you're about to say about pisiforms and, you know, sesamoid bones and all of these big words and things like that. Thumb is big toe.
Yes.
Index finger is not big toe.
No.
So this cannot be this. This is not this.
In fact, if you use the wrong contact, you actually create a turn in the wrong direction.
You create orientation.
Yeah. Well, you interfere with what you're actually trying to achieve. You literally go in the wrong direction. Yes.
Yeah. And we'll talk about that a little bit further. Yeah, yeah, yeah. But like, let's just get that. We'll get that as a starting point. It's this. So generalizing and saying this is your heel is also almost incorrect. Right, but incorrect.
It's like you get partial credit.
Yeah.
Right?
Okay. Yeah. So let's talk about what the true representation would be of the analogy of the foot to the hand.
You mean like that, like a heel to forefoot?
Yeah. And then we can talk about why walking like a handstand walk can't actually get you through the three phases of propulsion.
Yeah. Well, okay.
And then
let's be fair. You do go through the phases of propulsion. It's just that you're going to have to use compensatory actions to get there, right?
Sure.
Okay. Yeah. There's an evolutionary difference in regards to the hand versus the foot, because while you do have like a grasping capability to a certain degree in your foot, it's like this is designed for that. Right. Like this is designed for me to, this evolved, allows me to grab things, use tools, create stuff, pick your nose, hitchhike, etc. Right. So all that cool stuff. So, but when you lay your hand flat on the ground, it's not like laying your foot flat on the ground. You don't have the same capacity to capture ground contact. It just doesn't exist. Okay. And so we have to be very particular about how we use the hand, but because it is grasping, this is why we're big fans of dumbbells, kettlebells, and things like that, that have handles.
Like
you look at all the recon programs, it's like, if you don't have push-up handles and you're trying to do recon, well, good luck with that. Right. Because we really need you to be able to use those handles, because what we're trying to do is we're trying to influence these favorable contacts, because the hand contacts are inside your grasp. Like your hand contacts are there. Like you look straight down that line and you're literally looking straight through your hand contacts. Right. And so that means that this is not one. Like there's the load right through there. That's where you're going to load the hand, right? So that's going to be your ideal representation when you're trying to load through the extremity. So if we said, okay, the greatest superimposition of internal rotation on upper extremity is gonna have that hand contact, right? So if you make a tight fist, it's like you're literally putting pressure on those contacts,
right?
And like just when you handle, it's much more efficient because we're designed for the grasp.
Just so people can see, like, the contact we're talking about here, it's not here.
No, it's not up high in the palm would be a mistake. We talked about that too, actually. People that bench press with the bar sitting too far back in their hand, or they're knocking 20 pounds off of their bench press, right? Because they don't have the correct hand contact. Yeah.
Sure.
Yeah.
Okay. So go ahead.
Oh, well, I was going to say it's like this is how we superimpose the IR. That's why we're using grasping as elements, not a flat hand contact. Right. But when we're doing certain activities, like a low oblique sit, for instance, where we're trying to influence the ability to capture internal rotation in a low oblique activity, this is one of the reasons why we'll block certain segments of the hand, because what we don't want to do is we don't want to push the pistol side of your hand into the ground. That's the mistake. Because it literally turns the extremity in the wrong direction, right? Where we're trying to capture internal rotation from distal to proximal in this circumstance in a low oblique sit. And if you make that your hand contact, you just turn the wrong way. Like you dampened your ability to capture IR without question. Like
is there a simple way to say why to someone that might not be as detail-oriented or understand the model as well.
Well, okay, if you put pressure on that spot trying to push into the ground, the radius turns into ER.
Okay.
I mean, it's inevitable because that's what that pressure is supposed to do.
Right.
Like that's literally what it's designed to do.
I like to think of it too as like if in your foot, so as you go through like heel to toe rocker, mm-hmm. your heel, ankle, toe rocker sort of mechanism of that foot hitting the ground. If I don't get all the way to the medial aspect of my first metatarsal head, the typical pressure of push off comes from that like second toe mm-hmm. metatarsal. Mm-hmm. And that usually ends up leading to like neuromas and foot pathology. Right. Because that pressure is not supposed to be going through that spot. Is that the same reason? Is that the same ER result?
You actually have to use compensatory IR. You have to use a compensatory IR strategy in the hand to push that spot down.
Yeah. Okay.
Yeah. Yeah.
So if I was to misrepresent the hand to someone and say, oh, mm-hmm. When you're doing your push-up, just put a lot of pressure through this spot and your shoulder will feel better. Yeah. Your shoulder may in fact feel better, but it's because you are orienting the entire upper.
Right. So here extremity. You go. So here's what happens to the measurements. Here's what happens to the measurements. The shoulder IR measurement increases because the neck is moving further into IR. The thorax is orienting further into IR. Okay. So from a symptomatic standpoint, so this is the pickle that you run into. And this is like this is why I'm very particular about simple solutions and things like that, is because a lot of the solutions that are provided like on social media, it's like the symptomatic relief. Absolutely. Absolutely. But they're not the best choices because you're using compensatory strategies to magnify a measure elsewhere to substitute for the relative motion that would truly alleviate the problem.
Right.
You know, you see people doing some of these hip mobilizations with bands, and actually what they're doing is they're mobilizing the spine to a much greater degree. And then they find like, oh, wow, my squat improved. And then what they don't show is they don't show the compensatory spinal action that took place to allow you to access that space more comfortably. It's like, that's why you can't like symptomatic relief. Great. Love it. You know, big fan, you know, as our patients. But I don't want to, it's, I always compare this to giving a golfer a swing fault to fix a swing fault. It's like, it's like that really wasn't the solution. Like you alleviated a symptom.
Right? Yeah. And
I'm okay with that. Cause I get pain sucks. Totally sucks. But it's like, what is the next problem that you're creating by using a compensatory strategy to fix a compensatory strategy?
Yeah, typically when you have, so I'm going to try to simplify what you're saying. So typically when you have like an upper extremity issue, so you have like a shoulder pain, and, or you're basing everything off of, so you're doing your due diligence. You're trying to base everything off of key performance indicators. You're going based off of your table measures to see what we're improving, and you're getting like symptomatic relief, and your table measures seem to be improving. But what you're not taking into consideration, what Bill is saying, is that there is a compensatory sequence in action taking place at your neck, at your cervical spine, because that is the area in which you can twist and turn in order to fake a measurement. The same would be true for the lower lumbar spine, because these two areas of your spine have more degrees of freedom or more ability to turn away from and towards without any sort of like bony constraint, like you would see in the rib cage, I guess. Is that the best way to put it?
Well, I mean, there's constraints and there's limits, but what happens is, so whenever you take like a shoulder measurement or a hip measurement, you're not just measuring that joint. See, therein lies a big issue. That's a misunderstood representation. It's like if I'm measuring a shoulder, I have the humerus, I have the scapula, I have the ribs, I have the spine, all contributing to the measurement. Okay. Mm-hmm. When one of those is limited, I will get a magnification in one area potentially and a limitation in another. Okay. One of the interesting things is one of the great magnifications of hip measurements and shoulder measurements is the influence of the neck in regards to either ER or IR. Like, we can have compensatory strategies in both. And this is one of the reasons why, a lot of the shoulder measures get messed up is because they're not looking at the full chessboard. They're looking at things in isolation. So if I only take a few measures, I don't get a true picture of what is being represented in that joint. And so my perception is I'm measuring the shoulder when the reality is, it's like, okay, I could get 90 degrees of shoulder ER, which it would appear to be the normal, if you will, like it'll be perceived as normal, but it could be a magnification that's allowing that to happen in the neck. I could get 60 degrees of shoulder IR, which would appear to be relative, but it's actually coming from the neck, because I have to look at the relationships from side to side and from iterative elements of the anatomy.
Yeah.
Right. So I can determine what, like, am I actually using a compensatory strategy, or am I measuring something that is relative? Right. And so if we bring this back now, it's like, I use the wrong hand contact. I can reduce the symptoms. I can magnify a measure that appears like, if I only take one measure as my key performance indicator and go, well, I'm trying to get more shoulder IR. And if I only take that measurement and I magnify that, it increases, symptoms go down, and I go, way to go me. But I lost ER in the process, which means that the IR was never relative. Right. And that's going to be the place where I store and release the energy most efficiently. I alleviate tensions and pressures that would arise on tissue that will eventually cause potential structural changes and abnormalities that will ultimately become interfering.
Right.
And so that's why understanding this representation versus like the way that we look at a foot, like, yes, the same, but different.
Okay, let's talk about the analogous structures to try to clear this up for people, because we've hinted at it and we've kind of showed the spaces, but we haven't talked about direct like one-to-one relationships. So pisiform and sesamoid bones and all that.
Oh, you want to just like kind of go through them?
Yeah, I mean just simply like, this is heel is this, first metatarsal head of the foot is this.
And well, so you got here. Hang on. So when you read palms, you use the left hand, just for those folks at home. So if somebody tries to read your palm, they read in the right hand, you're reading the wrong one. Okay. Learn that from a gypsy. So this is your lifeline right here, this little crease in your hand, right? And so if you follow the lifeline, so there's the carpal ligament right there. Okay. And so if I go, what would be ulnar? Yeah. Ulnar side of the hand. So this is the hypothenar eminence here. And I go to the base of that. So this will be This is like your, where your pisiform would be located. And so this is going to be like the equivalent of a medial heel contact. So what I'm trying to do is I'm trying to get that to the ground. Okay. That's going to be my hand contact. Okay. To get over here, you're going to feel the majority of your hand on the ground. What I don't want to do though, is put pressure through here. There's the mistake. Because the minute I put pressure on that side of the hand, the radius is actually turning towards ER. For me to hold IR, I got to hold contact here. So I got to square this to the ground, just like when you talk about squaring a heel to the ground so we can propagate internal rotation through the foot. That's how I'm going to propagate internal rotation. Okay. When I'm using like a flat hand contact. So when we're talking about like, I don't know, prone on elbows or low obliques, you know, or whenever my hand is going to be on the ground, even in a high oblique sit or whatever it might be, like when the hand is going to be flat to the ground, that's the contact that I'm looking for.
Okay. So that's your early IR contact. And then as you go through the hand to get to the late IR contact, we need to talk about like the,
yeah,
we talked about how this isn't your first med head, but then your first med head would have to be your here.
It's sort of inside your hand, right there.
Okay. Yeah, and then what are the particular bones that are the exact analogy to the foot?
You have sesamoid bones right here in your thumb that are exactly in the same place in your foot.
Yeah, in the first the first metatarsal head.
Under the first metatarsal. Yes.
Yes.
Yeah, okay. And that's how you know. That's how you know.
Right.
Yeah.
So when people are asked like, well, what are you just guessing? Is there research on this? It's like, no, there's literally the same bone, the same type of bone.
Yeah.
So there's not a lot to, and you know, like the pisiform, if you look at it, it does kind of look like a calcaneus in a way. If you're like Bill and you take 4.5 hours and you just stare.
But there's a funky twist in some of the bones in your hand that throw off the representation. That's why it looks like it goes sideways. It looks like it goes this way. Yeah. Yeah. And it just has to do with the, again, this is the evolutionary pressures of what we needed and to do the cool stuff that we do.
Right. Yeah. So understanding that. Mm-hmm. Taking doesn't mean that you can't still try to make these sort of analogous activities between, you know, people try to do like crawling as like a form of gait for the upper body. It's not really how it goes, but you can get closer to it if you were to like crawl using push-up handles or to like even do stuff on like parallette bars, like holding yourself with those contacts that we're talking about in that sort of representation of the.
Yeah.
And I think another good way to think about it too is like if my thumb was actually approximating the rest of the joints of my hand, it would be twisted and turned into this orientation that we're saying. Like it would look exactly like it. But since we need opposable thumbs to be able to do the things that humans do, we've evolved away from the same. Because you know, you look at chimpanzees and stuff like that, who it's closer to what we're talking about than what we have.
That's why they're quadrupedal.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Cause they can get that. They can get that contact a little bit better. That's also why they have a different sort of shoulder scapular orientation as well.
Yeah.
Okay.
And pelvis. and pelvis. Right.
Yeah.
But we talked about that too. We talked about the, when did we talk about the gorilla that was walking upright?
Can't remember. It's been mentioned in so many different places.
Yeah.
Yeah.
It's in Philadelphia. Okay. I found that.
So, what else do we like drawing an out? Like trying to teach through analogy, I guess it's like there's not like a direct relationship between the hand and the foot contact stuff. So it's like, you can't think of things as like, you know, you hear people say things like, like a parallel bar dip is like the squat for the upper body or something like that. It's like not exactly the same.
It's close though.
Yeah.
I mean, I think it's useful enough. Like that comparison, like when you're on the parallel bars and you're doing a dip, that comparison is actually pretty useful.
Actually. Okay.
Because you're going to finish. Think about where you're going to finish. Like dead center middle, straight into the ground. You know, you're gonna have the appropriate contacts for dead center middle under that circumstance. So I think it's a pretty useful one. you just got to be careful. Like the execution is a little different.
Right? When you attempt to get to that early bottom representation of the dip, though, is when you're going to get a lot of that neck spinal compensatory motion.
Well, okay. So now we're just talking about like, what is the actual excursion of the joints that are available to you in that circumstance, sure. Right? Because the legs get twisted around, mm-hmm. you know, that's just a representation of the joint shape at that point.
Right.
And what you do have access to. People will always try to go further. Because more is better, right?
Right.
And so for you to access, so think about the degree of internal rotation that you actually need at the bottom of a dip to do with the extreme stretches and things like that. Mm-hmm. It's like you're exceeding relative motions at that point.
Right.
So you're going to use compensatory activities.
Crawling around on your hands without mm-hmm. push-up handles, using dumbbells that go straight across your hand versus mm-hmm. Like putting it through that uh-huh. space where you have uh-huh. to. So the mm-hmm. reason why kettlebells are so useful is because it forces you to have to put them because it's uncomfortable. Otherwise, if you go straight across the palm, the kettlebell will just whack you in the back of the arm or rest on a really weird spot, but it just nestles in really nicely.
It's so much easier
that spot there.
Yeah.
Which just makes it a good tool to use. And then
if you've ever fired a handgun.
Yeah.
Those are the hand contacts in a hand when you hold a hand.
Right.
Because if you don't, I got bad news for you. That gun is going to spin out of your hand. Yeah. Like it will literally spin out of your hand because people don't really understand the firepower just in a low caliber handgun. Mm-hmm. But you have to put those when they teach you to hold a pistol, it's like, that's why when you hold a kettlebell, like it's very much like a pistol grip because you're trying to load those points of contact.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Okay. I think we've circled through the hand and foot discussion.
Sweet.
What should we?
Did we record the Valley Girl part at the beginning of the
video? We did. We got the whole thing in there.
All right.
Well, isn't a question there though. Like, what's the question there? I was just going to ask.
I don't know. What's your favorite phrase? What's your favorite slang phrase from Valley Girl?
But the only two people that watch this are going to even know what that
is. Dale would probably know it, right? Because that's
what did you say? It was 84?
When
did
1983, that come out? 1983.
Okay. So 2 years before I was born.
I was in high school.
Yeah.
See, now I have this projection in my head as to how much older they am than you.
Yeah, you were driving a car before I was alive.
Wow. Little Chrissy Wykus.
Bill would be stealing my lunch money and giving me swirlies in the bathroom. I was just going to ask people what their like favorite gum is.
Oh, wait a minute. Just gum, or do we want to qualify this with bubble gum because there is a difference?
Well, I mean, let's do that. I mean, most people
which gum was it? Which bubble gum was it that everybody said had spider eggs in it? Was that bubble yum?
Oh, I don't remember. I think that was something that was a little more
so
before my
you
time.
You got bubble yum, you got bubblicious, you got Bub's Daddies. That was the big stick of big long tube of, you remember Bub's Daddy?
Nope. No, I don't think that was around when I was growing
up. Okay. So this was like a little league thing for me. So this would be like age 9 through 12.
Oh, we had big league chew by then.
Big League Chew was solid because what brilliant by the tobacco companies to start kids on Big League Chew because the next thing you knew is like you had a pouch of Red Man out in center field, you know, and when you were 14,
chewing
Red Man during a game.
Well, especially in Indiana.
Oh my gosh. Yeah. I had a buddy we were playing ball and he had done it for the first time and he was literally playing center field and he swallowed instead of spit. And that was that was his first mistake. Yeah. Bad.
Did it turned out poorly. Throw up all over center field.
It turned out poorly.
I can't think of like dip and chew without thinking of like the Sandlot when they all like go to the amusement park and they just are throwing up.
Yes.
That's so good. But the classics. Like gum, the big gum. So growing up was like, fruit stripe gum with the zebra.
Oh yeah.
That was a big one. A lot of people in my family worked for Wrigley's, so we got a lot of sweet. That gum. So we had like fruit, what was it called? Juicy Fruit. Like,
Juicy Fruit, sure.
Big Red. Mm. There's a lot
not
of
not a. I'm not a cinnamon guy. Cinnamon, so.
It's tough. It's an acquired. It like burns.
It yeah. It's like yeah. I'm not painful yeah. food. Like spicy food, good. Painful food, bad.
Well, that's and I
that's
mean,
just too much.
Arguably, too one of the reasons why people get addicted to soda is the actual pain response that comes along with the bubbles.
Oh, interesting. Yeah,
I read something about that. It's like a sort of endorphin pain, craving pain.
So does that increase your pain tolerance?
I don't know. But it's that combined with like the incredibly high amounts of sodium and sugar that just make you thirsty and thirstier and thirstier.
Yes.
But anyway, so like
brilliant
favorite, I'm trying to think of like my favorite gum. I think honestly, just in terms of an experience, this is not really like the like blow pops, the lollipops that had gum inside of them. It's a big a favorite
classic.
Of mine.
A yeah. classic. Like wait, you just got enough, a little bit of the crunch left in the gum. Yeah. No, I understand. Yeah,
I think that's like, probably a favorite. I did love Big League Chew too.
Big League Chew. See with these on. The only gum that I can chew right now is Free Dent, which okay. so it doesn't stick to my braces. Not a big fan. It's a lot like chewing dry cement.
Yeah. I'm a big, like the reason I'm asking is I have gum all over I got different like GI issues, and xylitol gum has actually been like a very big help for me.
Oh, good.
Cause xylitol is actually a biofilm disruptor. But I don't want to get too much into that. Like right now, my big ones, if anyone wants to know, Pure makes aspartame free and xylitol gum. And then this company, Epic, also makes really good. Nice. They want to sponsor the podcast.
I've heard good things about nicotine gum.
I have tried that. I mean, nicotine is neuroprotective. So it may actually.
It's kind of weird, right?
I think it gets a really bad rap because it's associated with tobacco.
Yeah.
And, you know, it's very carcinogenic to smoke tobacco, but nicotine.
Not the nicotine.
It might, I think we'll see a lot more nicotine being used as a therapeutic agent for people when they age.
So a lot of it has to do with dosage. So, so it's whether it comes in small doses or a very large dose. At once, because it has a differential effect depending on how much is in your system at any one time.
Yeah,
which is kind of cool.
For a while, I used to use the nicotine like lozenges, and I would break them in half, so I would get like 1 milligram or something like that. Cigarettes have like 10 in one cigarette or something wild like that. It's just like a very addictive substance, and I think it gets kind of thrown into the negative, it gets kind of looped in with the negative aspects of tobacco.
Smoking.
But I believe it is actually could be of benefit.
Not for everybody.
The only reason I stopped doing it is because it was bothering my stomach for a while. But anyways, so sweet. Hello to the five regulars that made it to the end. We'll see you later.